for years. It's wonderful to be part of it now. What follows, as we've heard, is a chapter from two medieval non-humanisms. And there's still time to entertain comments, corrections, or generative ideas for it. I just got an article on spontaneous generation that one of you wrote just last night, which I read this morning. It's a great deal of pleasure. I'm looking forward to hearing from you. If you'd like a copy of the paper, or if you'd like to read along as I present, I've put up a copy of the talk to here to medievalcarl.com. So there's no PowerPoint, there's no slide. There's just the text. But if you'd like all the names and so forth, it's right there. And I'll leave it up there for a couple of days or so. Despite what you may have been led to expect by the conference's title, my talk is not in fact about sex, but rather about reproduction, or rather generation, but of a sexless sort. I'll be focusing on the Middle Ages, in part because that's what I do, but also as a kind of ambassador for my scholarly field. Non-medievalists sometimes mistake my period as a kind of dead zone for thought, or as slopped off or disconnected from our present, except as an embarrassing remainder. Recall the pleonastic insult, medieval brutality, and so on. So I'd like to try to change that a little. So here's a picture of the way we generally expect reproduction to work, from Basil, 4th century bishop of Caesarea, a city located in what's now Turkey. He observed that nature, once put in motion by the divine command, traverses creation with an equal step through birth and death, and keeps up the succession of kind through resemblance to the last. Nature always makes a horse succeed to a horse, a lion to a lion, an eagle to an eagle. And preserving each animal by these uninterrupted successions, she transmits it to the end of all things. Animals do not see their peculiarities destroyed or effaced by any length of time. Their nature, as though it had just been constituted, follows the course of ages, forever young. Even here, you might notice that something is not quite right. Aristotle's On the Generation of Animals remarks that although, quote, anyone who does not take after his parents is really, in a way, a monstrosity, the first beginning of this deviation is when a female is formed instead of a male, though this indeed is a necessity required by nature. Which is to say, the first interruption of uninterrupted succession occurs with binary heterosexual reproduction itself. All boy children are really, in a way, monstrosities. Sexual reproduction is imperfect as reproduction, then, because it requires unlikeness, its generation, but not straightforwardly reproduction. But there's yet another strange form of generation that concerns me today, namely spontaneous generation. My talk will aim in some ways to recuperate this now discredited idea. Spontaneous generation is not quite the medieval term. The medieval terminological distinctions were rather between generatio univoca and generatio equivoca. That is, on the one hand, generation from a single source cause, or even voice, as voca comes from the Latin vox, voice, and on the other, generation from an ambiguous source. In generatio univoca, a horse produces a horse produces a horse, a human produces a human produces a human, and so on back to the primordial pairs, with the voice of God as the ultimate paternal creative principle, whatever the gender difference that materializes the operations of univocal generation. In generatio equivoca, for vermin and crawling things of all sorts, the cause is not a certain voice and certainly not sex either, binary or otherwise, but rather a process, indistinguishable from rejected, disordered, and shapeless materials, dust, filth, putrefaction, and slime, or from the general restlessness of the earth itself. For in medieval Christian thought, the earth was not solid, dull stuff. Instead it was, as Carolyn Walker Bynum's Christian Materialism points out, fertile, material, labial, percolating, forever tossing up grass, wood, horses, bees, sand, or metal, unquote. Although I'll vacillate indifferently between the two terms over the course of my paper, equivocal or equivocal happily suits my purposes much better as a term for this kind of generation than spontaneous does. The latter carries some hint of a thing happening automatically through its own efforts, a self-starter, if you will, whereas equivocal suggests indetermination, uncertainty, a resistance to being known completely, perhaps acting on its own, but perhaps being enacted in a way that could never be reduced to a singular cause. Consider an entry in Isidore of Seville's foundational medieval encyclopedia, his 7th century etymologies. which explains that worms are generated in putrid meat, the mothworm in clothing, the cankerworm in vegetables, the woodworm in wood, and the ptarmigan, whatever that is, in fat. Generated by what? By whom? Certainly not by sex. Something has gone awry. Sexual reproduction goes awry because of the very need for sexual difference. Asexual reproduction goes awry, we might say, because something happens we're ought not to. Because life crawls from disorder, a living something whose swarming, verminous character can hardly be distinguished at all from the disorder that produced it. What happens in and through this disorder happens because of multi-causal, indifferent material processes themselves, irreducible to any binary of agent and object, to any hierarchy of form and matter, untraceable to any principle of paternity or maternity. The resonances with contemporary eco-criticism may strike you as obvious. We've heard Stacey Alimo invoked today, Donna Haraway has been invoked today, and so on. Irigaray is also in the background of this. I expect you understand that. From the agents through at least the end of the 17th century, equivocal generation was simply a known fact, but generally a known fact about only a specific subset of life, often termed imperfect, but which I'll call crawling or swarming life. Aristotle's Natural History was the key resource, as when he spoke of, here I quote, some insects not derived from living parentage, but generated spontaneously, some out of the dew falling on leaves, others grow in decaying mud or dung, others in timber, green or dry, some in the hair of animals, some in the flesh of animals, some in excrements, and some from excrement after it has been voided, and some from excrement yet within the living animal. Albert the Great's 13th century commentary on Aristotle's work on animals makes exactly the same point. One must respond that some animals are generated from propagation and some from putrefaction. And those generated from putrefaction, there are no members designed for generation because they are not generated from semen. Bartholomew the Englishman's 14th century Encyclopedia of Natural History explains that the louse is birthed from moist, corrupt air and vapors that sweat out from between the skin and the flesh from pores. The snail in lime or of lime, note that, in lime or of lime, and is therefore always foul and unclean. Butterflies lay eggs in fruit and breed therein worms that come of their own stinking filth. And that fleas lay eggs without mixing of male and female. No one seems to have found the science anything but common sense. Basil the Great remarks that on a hot rainy day in Thebes, hordes of field mice swarm from the earth, and that the mud alone produces eels. They do not proceed from an egg, nor from any other manner. It is the earth alone which gives them birth. Isidore's Etymology just as blandly observes that many people know from experience that bees are born from the carcasses of oxen, hornets from horses, drones from mules, and wasps from asses. And without any expectation of disagreement, Augustine explains that Noah had no need to coax equivocally generated life forms into his ark, not two by two, right? Because God specifically commanded him to gather only male and female animals. In other words, those generated through sexual reproduction. In any way, vermin would have infested the ark as they do any house, quote, not in any determinate numbers, unquote. They're not countable, that is. The problem was not the natural science itself, but rather how equivocal generation challenged God's monopoly on creation. If equivocal life comes from putrefaction, and if the created world was perfect before Adam and Eve's expulsion from Eden, then creeping things may have emerged only after God had finished making the world. Though creeping life, reptiles in Latin, is created twice in the Bible's first creation story, in Genesis 1:20 and also in 1:24, it is notably almost entirely absent from medieval artistic depictions of creation, in which the absence perhaps acknowledges that such a form of life had yet to emerge in the earth's first uncorrupt days. No doubt the absence is partly due to technical constraints. Creeping things would have been too small to illustrate easily, particularly on the sixth day of creation, crowded as that day was with the creation of quadrupeds and humans. However, even when artists had ample space, as in carvings on cathedrals, they still tended to omit the creation of vermin. So I've seen a few examples, but it's really striking how few they are compared to the vast majority of them where there are no snakes or worms. etc. Who or what could be responsible for them? Medieval Christian thinkers offered a range of solutions, more or less convincing, to preserve a divine or at least a celestial cause for swarming life. For example, Robert Grosseteste, 13th century Bishop of Lincoln, felt compelled to defend God's sole responsibility for the ongoing production of oysters, here presumably standing in as a paradigmatic equivocal critter. According to Grosseteste, since oysters evidently generate from the water itself, God's increase and multiply had to apply to oysters in some specific way particular to them, not by the propagation of things brought forth one from another, but rather, he says, through a multiplication of individuals that are begotten from water. That's not very convincing. Other writers using Aristotle concocted better explanations by following a more logical, less haphazard system in which the earth is cold and life requires warmth from some source or other. Thus, for Duns Scotus, stellar heat operated on a cow's corpse, inscribing the matter in such a way that it might produce bees, a work ascribed to Albert the Great, Albertus Magnus. Similarly explains that when the sun heats rotting matter, trapped heat causes vibrations within the matter, which produce spirit, and thus life. The actual Albert the Great insists that animals sprung from putrefaction require, quote, a superior power and an inferior power. The inferior power disposes the matter for putrefaction, into which once it has been disposed, the celestial power is introduced, operating on the matter just as sperm operates on the menses. Albert's solution suggests an effort to keep God ultimately responsible, in this case through a deputized virtus caelestis, a heavenly patriarchal force working like God on merely reception feminine sublunary matter. The Middle Ages' most respected resolution to the problem belongs to Augustine's On the Trinity. In the course of examining the competing serpent-creating miracles between Moses and the magicians of Pharaoh's court, that's in Exodus 7, 9 through 12, Augustine explains that demons have no power to create matter, and neither, in fact, is anything else but God. Rather, during creation, God had interwoven a natural seminal power in all life, from which they produced particular kinds of seemingly new things, like serpents. Elsewhere in the Genesis commentary, he suggests that these seeds might have been implanted on creation's third day, along with the seeds of plants. Interestingly enough, that means that they were created before other forms of animal life. Although putrefaction had not yet happened at the time of creation, seemingly spontaneous life had already been provided for by God's foresight. All these explanations sought to keep God ultimately responsible, and through that to preserve hierarchies between object and agent, matter and spirit, and a host of other inequitable distinctions these divisions attach themselves to, like paternal form and feminine matter. And all the explanations themselves, through these strange extra-biblical interventions, attest to some worry over whether all life is a life enabled by spirit. The stakes of the problem become even clearer in the waning days of spontaneous generation, from the 17th to the 19th centuries. The typical story is one that culminates in Louis Pasteur's conclusive demonstration that a sufficiently sterile environment would prevent even the smallest microbes from arising, and with that, a conclusive demonstration that things in themselves have no power to bring forth something new. The counter-narrative is perhaps equally familiar. Some 30 years ago, the story of the death of spontaneous generation became a key site for the social history of knowledge, in which the victory of Pasteur over Félix Archimède Pouchet could be understood not simply as the rise and triumph of experimental science over ancient superstition, but instead, or at least also, as a victory of Pasteur's Catholicism and imperial sympathies over Pouchet's Protestant republicanism. Differences that themselves correspond to two distinct understandings of what matter can do, monarchical matter versus republican matter, we might say. In 1864, Louis Pasteur denounced spontaneous generation as an ally of atheism. Quote, "What a triumph, gentlemen, it would be for materialism if it could affirm that it rests on the established fact of matter organizing itself, taking on a life of itself." In the same year, he again argued that, quote, "If we also granted matter this other force we call life, life in all its many manifestations, varying as it does according to conditions under which it encountered, what would be more natural but to deify it. What could be gained from recourse to the notion of an original creation to whose mystery we must defer? What use the idea of a divine creator? What use indeed? Roughly 180 years earlier, Ralph Cudsworth's massive, true intellectual system of the universe, wonderful, had made exactly the same point without feeling compelled to don scientific costume, quote, to assert that all the effects of nature come to pass by material and mechanical necessity, or the mere fortuitous motion of matter without any guidance or direction, is a thing no less irrational than it is impious and atheistical, unquote. To preserve reason, which for both Pasteur and Cudsworth is much the same thing as preserving God, matter and motion and life must all be dependent ultimately on some divine or quasi-divine monopoly on a final creative power. Pasteur, the modern scientist, has more than a little in common with his medieval predecessors. And the defense of divine powers was unexpectedly also a defense of human particularity. Cudsworth's late 17th century contemporaries Antony von Leeuwenhoek and Jan Swammerdam provide a surprising example of such motivation in response to their microscopic examinations of insects. In this little world, they discovered an astonishing richness of detail, especially in insect wings. They were astonished because of traditions inherited from Aristotle and Albert the Great that held that the more perfect an animal, the more differentiated its parts. Insects should have been minimally detailed, unglorious, uncomplicated, and ugly. But if such beauty could arise from merely material processes by the work of filth upon itself, then by extension other complex creatures, humans in particular, could ultimately arise in just the same way. Leeuwenhoek and Swammerdam had to find some cause of insect reproduction more aligned to what they believed to be the typical sexual modes of animal reproduction. Recognizing the centrality of human dignity to their research helps explain why these and other 17th century natural scientists were so dedicated to defending the doctrine of bodily resurrection as well. For if human life, like swarming life, could just arise from natural processes, then what spirit could persist after our bodies returned to the swarming earth? Resurrection promises a release from mundane flux. A spontaneously generated soul forces us to recognize that there's no escape from this or any other earth. Even the attempts to preserve a responsible celestial power for apparently spontaneously generated life could end up imagining a human self entirely immanent to the ongoing flux of mortal existence. To remind you, many thinkers held the sun, or even every celestial body, responsible for equivocal generation, explaining that when rotting matter was heated with the right kind of heat, a membrane formed that trapped the heat, which in seeking to escape vibrated the matter, which vibrations forced the soul to generate, and with that, life. From this, it could be but a short intellectual step to propose a fully material concept of the soul, distinguishable in function from matter, but not quite a separable, independent principle of identity. A completely immanent concept of life, that is. One astonishing speculative thinker along these lines was Blaise of Parma, whose dates, roughly speaking, were 1347 to 1416. Alternately known as Blasius Biagio Pallacini di Parma, or to his enemies as the Doctor Diabolicus, that's my favorite. His present fame, such as it is, rests largely on his work on optics and weights. His optical theories led him to argue that intellection was a form of sense perception, and since sense perception requires a distinct object but available to perception, so too did the intellect. And since the objects of the sense are material, so too are the objects of intellection, that is, thought. The conclusion about the materiality of thought led him on to this astonishing last point. The final conclusion, that the human intellection comes from the potentiality of matter, generable and corruptible. I'll repeat that. Human intellection comes from the potentiality of matter, generable and corruptible. Human reason here is the effect of ongoing imperfect material processes. That's where it comes from. Blaise reached similar conclusions in considering the problem of equivocal generation. Agreeing with Avicenna rather than Aristotle, Blaise argued that not just gnats, bees, mice, toads, and the like could emerge equivocally, but that all life could, including human life. For, I quote, "Nothing prevents this matter so prepared by natural causes from receiving a form which has the capacity to discern, to reason, and so on, which is commonly called the intellective power." Wild. Some of you might know Avicenna's influence on another work, the Hayy ibn Yaqsan, that is, alive, son of awake, written by the 12th century Iberian Muslim scholar Ibn Tufayl, translated into Latin in the later 17th century as Philosophus Autodidactus, a very famous work, very widespread. Tufayl's philosophical novel is a kind of theological experiment that tries to demonstrate that the highest divine truths can be arrived at simply through human reason. Thus, Tufayl needed to imagine a human free of any influence from written revelation or inherited tradition. He needed a completely isolated person. He solved the problem by imagining an island at the equator, uncommonly hot, and thus not unlikely to produce just the highest kind of terrestrial soul, a rational one, spontaneously. We don't know if Ibn Tufayl ever had to defend himself against this point, but Blaise was eventually forced to recant his views, which also included an argument that the story of the Ark was just a myth, an unnecessary solution to a false problem, given that the post-diluvian world just would have given rise again to all the life that had once inhabited it. God could have just wiped us all out. It would have been fine. In Blaise and Tufayl and a couple other medieval thinkers, all life, vermin, human, and otherwise, could be produced naturally through a non-miraculous interaction between a mobile earth and a mobile sky. Life for them is not something added to matter, but just one of the things that matter does. And looking ahead from Leeuwenhoek and Swammerdam into modern science, we must now recognize that all generation is spontaneous if tracked back far enough. Darwin himself made the admission in a letter written not long before Pasteur was celebrating his victory over Pouchet, when he recognized that life must be at its origin, abiogenetic. To put all this another way, at the very moment spontaneous generation was giving way to modern science, abiogenesis returned with a recognition that life had been aimlessly created through the impersonal, restless creativity of dawn life. Of course, the differences between spontaneous generation and origin of life research should not be obscured or dashed past. Origin of life research hypothesizes about the development of a paragenetic continuity and openness to adaptation across generations. It provides irreversible historical narratives with key transitional points of the long rise of DNA out of an RNA world, intends to insist that the time of abiogenesis is long over, at least on Earth. Life requires at least a combination of both genetic continuity and an openness to the environment that allows for adaptation, which is to say, life requires cross-generational genetic continuity and discontinuity. Spontaneous generation, by contrast, is discontinuous, as much a closed loop in its own way as pre-Darwinian assertions that like always produces like. Flies produce flies, the flies die and return to filth, and so on. And spontaneous generation may be inscrutable, but it does not relegate its processes to the great temporal differences of the 100 million year rise of DNA out of RNA, or to the great speed of chemical reactions occurring in a millionth of a second. Spontaneous generation happens right before us, though of course it does not actually happen as we now know. Yet over the long time of life, matter still swarms in mundane, perhaps inevitable ways that require no transcendent divine catalyst or any supposedly atheological equivalent, like life, to get going. The campaign against spontaneous generation in various incongruent, profane materialisms must therefore be understood as something other than that of a modern split from medieval habits. We should therefore not draw a line between medieval superstition and modern science, but rather between acceptances of material immanence and a faith in immaterial transcendence, and by extension, a faith in the existence of clear lines between decisive agents and mere objects. The border between immanence and transcendence must be understood as grammatical, per Nietzsche's famous critique in Twilight of the Idols of the metaphysics of language, which he argues persists in differentiating between a doer and doing, and asserting some will is the cause, or more simply classifying things into clear subjects and predicates between a matter that needs something or someone to make it happen, and matter whose operations cannot be neatly sorted into effect, an external cause, object, and external subject. The end of Nietzsche's critique is well known. I'm afraid that we are not rid of God because we still have faith in grammar. In short, spontaneous generation is godless because it is ungrammatical. In these equivocal operations, there is nothing of what Thomas Aquinas called an aspect of generation and sonship, where paternal life transmits information, a word here freighted with all its etymological weight of giving form. The information of supposedly normal paternal life is matters informing spirit, potentially separable from any particular materialization so long as it can be transmitted and received properly by other matter, so long, that is, as it can continue to establish a traceable lineage. By these criteria, spontaneous generation fails. The signal meant to be transmitted by God's first creative command has been cut off or has reconstituted itself on its own terms. Two last asides as I make my way towards my conclusion. First, spontaneous generated life tends to be creeping life. Worms, maggots, insects, snakes, eels, things many of us find more than a little repulsive. But we need not be so shaken up by that. There is no need to go along with Georges Bataille, whose exploration of human limits delighted in the prodigality of life, the slimy menace of death, and our anguish over that, I'm quoting him, the nauseous rank and heaving matter, frightful to look upon, a ferment of life teeming with worms, grubs, and eggs. To apprehend the heaving stuff of worms and body as repulsive is to view things only from our own perspective and our own imagined order. It is to see things from the side of God or of masculine certainties about the perfect body, without holes, unleaking, etc. It is to place ourselves and our counterparts on the side of life with politics and a face, as if we, at least, are echoes of God's primordial commandment, preserving the proper paternal traditions of creation through our well-ordered but threatened bodies, and to relegate everything else to the side of mere being. We could try abandoning that hope for a beautiful singular creator, beautifully concerned chiefly with our coming beautiful perfection. Down here on earth, creeping things happen through the inscrutable eccentric operations of matter, without any transcendent pretensions of cause disentangled from an effect. We can try viewing ourselves the same way. Second, as many of you know, sexual reproduction is, statistically speaking, an aberration, as most species don't reproduce sexually. John Launer repeats a common observation along these lines in his recent essay, "Do We Even Need Men?" I'm quoting him. There are asexual variants among all sorts of creatures, including jellyfish, dandelions, lichens, and lizards. Of the creatures who do reproduce sexually, some species have two sexes, but others have three, or 13, or 10,000 if you're a fungus. It's incomprehensible to me. It's wonderful. Against this, we have works like George Ripley's 15th century Compound of Alchemy, which explains that, quote, things there be no more, except kind within kind and number two, male and female, agent and patient. Okay. Once again, binary gender and binary gendered notions of sexual reproduction support a host of other binary systems, but in comparison to what we know about reproduction now, or indeed what medieval people believed they knew about spontaneous generation, nothing could be more simplistic than that binary system. So, vermin swarm from and in matter without any sexual intermediary, without paternal transmission, without a singular cause or singular voice, without a quality separable from their temporary affiliations. Vermin then return to Earth, possibly to arise again at some point if conditions are right, but possibly not. What returns has no distinct informational line that could possibly be traced from parent to child. If this stuff is life, it must be life completely immanent to its temporary ordering of stuff, without any of the informational, transcendent, and spiritual implications that life carries, and without any split between its particular manifestation and a transcendent life principle. That is, the equivocally generated life ultimately offers us what we might call a disanimated, corporeal model of life, barely distinct from the matter, from which it temporarily emerges and to which it will return. If information is not distinguished from material structure, then we have the tools for a radically non-spiritual, non-paternal, and non-vital conceptualization of objects in general, living things included. If this stuff is body, it is not body's origin or ground or the prediscursive repressed matter underneath social and gender codes. Individuation now need not be something that happens through the application of spirit or vitality or writing or code to matter. It can be understood to happen with matter itself through its inseparable organization within a roiling field of other matter. We could do better then by recognizing the following. Fundamental disorder is not a problem particular to vermin, but rather one general to all that is. To call it disorder, rather than, for example, endless generativity, is to continue to think too highly of ourselves. We ourselves and our worldly counterparts are also immanent to material vibrancy or constantly erupting disorder. We are therefore not alive so much so long as being alive means having some escape from presumably inert, dead, or uncreative materiality. That the opposition life-death, with fertility on the side of life and sterility on the side of, on the side of death, it's unsupportable. It doesn't work. And vibrancy will always swarm forth from putrefaction, exhaustion, failure, or for that matter, the ineluctable instability of matter, to try to sustain its own new temporary order, and it will continue to do so long past anything we can imagine is past the point of caring. And that's my manifesto and my argument for the benefits of starting our thinking with equivocal generation. Thank you.